Puttapada Sutta, this discourse appears in long length saying, Diga Nikaya, the ninth discourse. I have heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jetha's grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Now on that occasion, Puttapada, the wanderer, together with a large following of about 300 wanderers, had taken up residence in the debating hall near the Tinduka tree, in the single pavilion park of Queen Mallika. Then the Blessed One, early in the morning, taking his robes and bowl, entered Savatthi for alms. Then the thought occurred to him, while it is still too early to go into Savatthi for alms, why don't I go to the debating hall near the Tinduka tree in the single pavilion park of Queen Mallika to see Puttapada, the wanderer. So he went to the debating hall near the Tinduka tree in the single pavilion park of Queen Mallika. Now on that occasion, Puttapada the wanderer was sitting with his large following of wanderers, all making a great noise and racket, discussing many kinds of bestial topics of conversation about kings, robbers, ministers, state, armies and so on. So, the frivolous talks, that's what they do. And then Puttapada saw that the Blessed One was coming, and then he said, "Be quiet, good sirs, don't make any noise. Here comes Gautama the contemplative. He is fond of quietude and speaks in praise of quietude. Maybe if he perceives our group as quiet, he will consider it worth his while to come our way." So the wanderers fell silent. Then the Blessed One went to the Puttapada, and Puttapada said to him, "Come, Blessed One, welcome, Blessed One. It has been long time since the Blessed One has gone out of his way to come here. Sit down, Blessed One, this seat has been prepared." So the Blessed One sat on the prepared seat, Puttapada taking a lower seat, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, the Blessed One said to him, "For what topic of conversation are you gathered together here? In the midst of what topic of conversation have you been interrupted?" When this was said, Puttapada replied, "Never mind, Lord, about the topic of conversation for which we have gathered here. It won't be difficult for the Blessed One to hear about that later. For the past few days, a discussion has arisen among the many sects of priests and contemplatives gathered and sitting together in the debating hall concerning the ultimate cessation of perception, that is Abhisanya Nirodha. How is there the ultimate cessation of perception with regard to this world? Some say a person's perception arises and ceases without a cause, without reason. When it arises, one is percipient. When it ceases, one is not percipient. That is how one group described the ultimate cessation of perception." So you can see the Buddha's time, how they were thinking about this, the perception. You know, the perception arises and ceases, there's no cause. Then someone else said, "No, that is not how it is. Perception is a person's self, atta, which comes and goes. When it comes, one is percipient. When it goes, one is not percipient." That is how one group described the ultimate cessation of perception. It is interesting to know that those people are actually thinking about these things at that time. Then someone else said, "No, that is not how it is. For there are priests and contemplators of great power, great potency. They draw perception in and out of a person. When they draw it in, one is percipient. When they draw it out, one is not percipient." That is how one group described the ultimate cessation of perception. Then someone said, "No, that is not how it is. For there are devas of great power, great potency. They draw perception in and out of a person. When they draw it in, one is percipient. When they draw it out, one is not percipient." That is how one group describes the ultimate cessation of perception. Then the memory of the Blessed One arose within me. "Ah, the Blessed One, the Blessed Well Gone, the Well Gone, who surely is well skilled in these matters. The Blessed One is skilled and expert in ultimate cessation of perception. So what, Lord, is the ultimate cessation of perception?" In this regard, Puttapada, those priests and contemplatives who say that person's perception arises and ceases without a cause, without reason, are wrong from the very start. Why is that? Because a person's perception arises and ceases with a cause, with a reason, with training. One perception arises with training, another perception ceases. And what is that training? So Buddha saying, with the training, perception come to arise. and with the training, perception ceases. And this, the last week, you can remember, we discussed Mahanidana Sutta, and we look at the feeling, and people are regarding that the feeling as self, and then the feeling ceases, and then that person, because there are three kind of feeling, pleasurable feeling, displeasure feeling, and neither pleasurable nor non-pleasurable feeling. So if someone regards the feeling as self, and then the pressure, displeasure, pleasurable feeling as self, then the displeasure arises, I myself disappear. So it's not befitting to regard the feeling as self. The today discussion is completely about the perception. One regarding the perception as self. And so this is really good for anyone meditating on perception. And it's a bit hard for a beginner to do. But this knowledge acquired by learning this Dhamma is massive, in the sense it helps quite a lot in the meditation. Although you don't see it at once, if you read it one time and then for the second time and so on, it has a really big power in the meditation. So Buddha said that, with the training this perception arises, with the training it ceases. So the perception is something that comes and goes with the training. And what is that training? There is the case where Tathagata appears in the world, worthy and rightly self-awakened. And translator cut down that part. It is referring to the Samanapala Sutta in long length sayings. So we are not going to go through detail here, probably. We might discuss that discourse some other day. But in short, what it says is that the Tathagata arises in the world, Arahant, fully enlightened Buddha. And so there's the meaning of the Vithviso Bhagava Gatha, so the about the welfare. And so then he teaches Dhamma, and then someone hears this Dhamma. And so that particular person go from household life to homeless life, become a bhikkhu. And then he shave his head and the yellow robes put on. And then he dwells restrained by the rules of conduct, the Vinaya. So then observing commitment he has regarding the body, deed and word. And he purifies his life with the morality. And then so how they purify that the morality, the abandon in the taking of life, he dwells restrained from taking of life. So the killing, stealing, sexual misconduct and all those things sort of removed and have the right livelihood. And then so when one see that there is morality and no danger from any side because of those things, he experiences himself a blameless bliss that comes from maintaining the Aryan morality. So you see, the value of the morality is that no one is blaming if someone has got the morality. That if you have the virtue, right, no one is blaming. And most importantly, you yourself is not blaming you because of the morality. So you have the tranquility, inner tranquility because of that one. I'm happy because that I haven't broken those things. And then he guards his sense doors, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and the mind. And then because of those things, let's say he is going in a tour anywhere, he is not grasping anything. So those things are not coming to the eye, ear, nose, you know, that those are restrained. It's untouched. Those faculties are untouched by seeing any object. Because of that one, he experiences within himself the blameless bliss that comes from maintaining this Aryan guarding of the faculties. So there is this sukha, happiness, because of that. And then he is mindful and clear awareness is there, that is going forward, backward and so on. And whether sleeping or eating, and he is mindful about these things. And so there is this clear awareness. And then how is monk contented? Here monk satisfied with the robe to protect his body, with arms to satisfy his stomach, and having accepted sufficient, he goes on his way. Just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, burdened by nothing but its wings, so he is satisfied. There's nothing else to carry. Then he keep it R in morality, the R in restraint of senses, R in contentment, and find solitary lodging. And then he's going to this meditation places, and then he meditate, you know, abandoning the sensual desire, the ill will, sloth and torpor, and restlessness and worry and doubt. And then he attained into the first jhana, those jhana states. Now, Buddha goes in how he abandoned these things, like if you abandon this sensual desire, for example, just as a man who had taken loan to develop his business and whose business has prospered, might pay off his old debts and with what was left over could support a wife, might think, before this I developed my business, my borrowing, but now it has prospered. Now he has getting rid of those things and he's happy, right? So sensual desire is suppressed, that he's happy like that. And so Buddha quite a lot details about this one. So this, the other part is over here. So the hindrances, all the hindrances, if you look at the ill will part, for example, that just as a man who was ill, suffering, terribly sick, with no appetite and weak in body, might after some time recover and regain his appetite and bodily strength, and he might think, before this I was ill, and now he can actually taste, even the honey was given, person can't sort of take with the sick person. So if you have ill will, anger, and someone might be actually offering you a good thing, but you can't use that one. Because of that, you always reject, I don't want it. Even the children are saying, I don't want it. They can't take it at that time. And the third one, sloth and torpor, for example, just as a man might be bound in prison and after time he might be freed from his bonds without any loss, with no deduction from his possessions, he might think, before that I was in prison. Right? And now he's out of that danger, and he would rejoice and glad that he's out of the prison. So Thinamitta, the sloth and torpor is something like that, because you don't feel like doing anything with that. And the fourth one, just as a man might be a slave, not his own master, dependent on another, unable to go where he like, and after some time he might be freed from slavery. Able to go where he liked, might think, before this I was a slave. He couldn't enjoy, he couldn't do anything, he was had the slavery. Now he can rejoice. And so this discourse, that part is over here, that seeing these five hindrances have been abandoned within him, he become glad. Glad he become enraptured. Enraptured, his body grows tranquil, his body tranquil, he is sensitive to pleasure, feeling pleasure, his mind become concentrated. So he get that pamujjanti first, that whenever, so this is one statement, that how do you get rapture, for example. Whenever you realize that five hindrances have been abandoned by the time of meditation, then you get the rapture, you get the happiness. So these are gone. So that's the thing one can determine, that it's gone, and at that time. Gone mean doesn't mean it's gone forever. In the meditation time, it's suppressed. It's no longer coming up. So we become glad, and then rapture arises. When someone got the rapture, then get the tranquility. And when the body is tranquil, and this is pleasurable, so therefore his mind become concentrated. So, quite withdrawn from sensual pleasures, withdrawn from unskilled mental qualities, the monk enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal accompanied by direct thought and evaluation, that is the initial application and sustained application. His earlier perception of sensuality ceases, and on that occasion, there is a perception of refined truth of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. On that occasion, he is one who is percipient of refined truth of rapture and pleasure, born of seclusion. And thus, it is that with training, one perception arises, and with training, another perception ceases. So the previous perception was, in the ordinary life, is that regarding the sensual pleasures. maybe something that you are eating, it's pleasurable, eat, and happy about that thing. And so when you think about the peril of those things and withdrawn from those sensuality, one would go into the first jhana concentration. So this, there's this initial application and sustained application over here, that is for nekkhamma, that is for the renunciation. So initial application is for renunciation. So one would indulge in sensual things, and one would see the peril that I am being born in this, to this world, and then I am affected by this cold, heat and all those things. And I have to feed this body, you know, maintain these things, earn money to do that one, and all those troubles, one would see the problems. Having seen that one, and one would see that, why would I suffer? The renunciation would be better for me. So he applies his mind for the thought of renunciation of those sense pleasures. So, and also for non-ill will, not having the ill will, bad thoughts, angry thoughts, and also non-hurtfulness. So those are the initial applications and sustained applications. You keep on maintaining that one. Now these things are not for me, I'm giving up those things and so on. So if you are successful, then those hindrances will be abandoned by that time and attain the first jhana concentration, which is rapturous. So previously we had the perception about the sensual pleasure. Now we have perception about the rapture. So with the training, the previous one ceases, the another one comes to arise. So you can see the perception is not something permanent. It always change. It can be trained into going to a good direction and have the happiness. Then with the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, the monk enters and remains in the second jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of composure, unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance, his early perception of refined truth of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion and seclusion ceases. And on that occasion, there is a perception of refined truth of rapture and pleasure born of concentration. On that occasion, he is one who is percipient of refined truth of rapture and pleasure born of concentration. And thus, it is that with training, one perception arises, and with training, another perception ceases. So, you can see that in the first jhana level, that you need to keep on applying that technique, that these things are not for me, these things are trouble for me, so I don't want to have those things. So, he would read the first jhana. Having read the first jhana level, you see that then you get sort of used to this idea. You keep on maintaining it without applying it. You don't, because you see, even if you train a child to do something, and you know, first you draw these things and sort of thing, and after some time you don't have to say, no instructions needed for a child to do that one. You can do that. Like that one, if you have the practice, you can straight away do that one. So now the rapture and pleasure is there. Without initial application and sustained application, I don't have to apply, these things are not mine, I don't want it, and all those things, that trouble is not there. So now we can see there was a pleasure before, rapture before, in the first jhana, that one ceases, and you have the rapture without initial application and sustained application, which is better, because I'm less working now, I used to it, the idea. And then in the next one is that he reached the third jhana concentration. So, how does he reach the third jhana concentration? And then with the fading of rapture, he remains equanimous, mindful and alert, and senses pleasure with the body. He enters and remains in the third jhana, of which the Noble One declare, equanimous and mindful, he has pleasant abiding. His earlier perception of refined truth of rapture and pleasure, born of concentration, ceases. And on that occasion, there is a perception of refined truth of equanimity. On that occasion, he is a one who is percipient of refined truth of equanimity, and thus it is with this training, one perception arises, with the training another perception arises. So there is this rapture, and what happened with the rapture? When you have this rapture, rapture is sort of, for a person who does not have it at all, is the gold. It's really valuable thing. But when you have it for a long time, and it's troublesome, because you have a goal set up, you know, I want to go to Nibbana, not this rapture. Rapture is a byproduct of this thing. And so, it's like a water flowing and starting from your head or somewhere. It's just flowing water. It's not water actually, it's the pulse going every place. And you get fed up with that one. You know, it's troublesome. It's like a burning, you know, fire sort of thing. Although you are happy, when you have the rapture, there is this pleasure associated with it. You would prefer the pleasure rather than the rapture. Without the rapture, you would like to have the pleasure. So, that the rapture fades away, then you arrive at the pleasurable feeling. So that's the third jhana level of concentration. And if someone is mindful, that is the highest. And equanimous and mindful, that's the highest sort of thing, pleasurable thing. And then with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with early disappearance of elation and distress, the monk enters and remains in the fourth jhana. Purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain, his early perception of refined truth of equanimity ceases, and on that occasion there is a perception of refined truth of neither pleasure nor pain. On that occasion, he is one who is percipient of refined truth of neither pleasure nor pain. And thus it is said, it is that with training one perception arises, and with training another perception ceases. So, now, got rid of the first jhana, went to the second one, got to the second one, entered and abided in the third one. So, this is pleasurable. Now, what happened when the pleasure ceases? As far as, when the pleasure ceases, you get displeasure. When the displeasure is the cessation of displeasure, right? So, when the displeasure ceases, you get pleasure. So, then this person is sort of get fed up with that idea that when this one ceases, I have fallen. Now, what if I get rid of both? The pleasure as well as the displeasure. Whether the somnas, dhammas, all those things, he get rid of that one. So, in that particular time, you have the equanimity, because that means you are going to become indifferent to the feeling that has arisen in the third jhana level. So you would read the fourth jhana level and you maintain that one. There's a big step over there though, because we used to have the pleasure all the time. We used to, live with the pleasure and happy with the pleasure. And there's a bit of a reluctant or something going beyond that level. Also, there is a big gap or time one need to go into the other one. So, but the fourth jhana is so beautiful in that sense, because that it's like that your skull is sort of open, then you are not focusing on your head area or anything like that on in that level. And it's like the skull is open. So when your skull is open, you don't actually have any tensions or anything over here. So, you can maintain, if you can maintain it for a long time, you can't explain this one any further than this, it's really good. So, you can see that the perception about the pleasure was now ceased. Now, there's this equanimity. And then with the contemplate transcending of perception of physical form, with the disappearance of perception of resistance and not heeding perception of diversity, perceiving infinite space, the monk enters and remains in the dimension of the infinite truth of space. His earlier perception of a refined truth of neither pleasure nor pain ceases, and on that occasion there is a perception of a refined truth of the dimension of infinite truth of space. On that occasion he is one who is a percipient of the refined truth of dimension of the infinite truth of space. And thus it is that with training one perception arises, and with training another perception ceases. So, again we discussed this one last week as well, that remember that example about the two people going to a mountain slope. One is climbing up the mountain. When the one person is climbing up the mountain, we can see with that distance, this that the whatever the characteristics this particular person had before is now not significant, because you do not sort of grasp any signs and features of that person when you are far away, because they are, you can't see them that much. So you go to the top of the mountain, you can see this is a very tiny little thing, and you probably don't even recognize this person. And whatever, if you go far away from that one and to a star, and you are looking at this place, so you can see that it's this earth, very tiny, tiny dot sort of thing, and it's non-significant. Now, this great earth, we take it as really a big and valuable thing, although you are not thinking that you are thinking about it. There's an earthquake or something like that. Or people get very disturbed, you know, that because we exist on this earth, and it's a great value. And there's a huge clinging regarding that. Now, if you're far away, this becomes non-significant because all the other stars, moons, and all those things are there. And they are also tiny, and the houses become tiny, and the people inside it, you know, negligible. There's nothing at that particular time.
So then at that time, your perception is for not on the earth at all.
No, not at all. No any material thing. Even stars. Nothing. Space.
This is only because you meditate, isn't it?
Yeah.
And for another person, so that is just the ignorance. That for an animal, and so the world of a human being, that
it's a bigger thing.
Yeah, maybe not a concern at all because of the ignorance.
Mm. Yeah, so actually this state also has got a bit of ignorance. This state itself has got ignorance. They're not knowing the impermanent nature. But if you compare that these states, the animals, if someone is playing of departed or hell, they are thinking, oh, it would be really good, even I can be born as an animal.
So how does that person know that there are beings called animals? If there is a person in hell.
There is this thing, and they were even actually asking those questions as well about the, you know, this a deity is asking those questions from you. Didn't you see the divine signs and sort of thing? And they have the knowledge in certain places. They have the knowledge that, you know, even if you read this. The 50th discourse in the Middle End, say, in the Venerable Sariputta, he was the Mara, Dusim Mara, in one of the Buddha's time. And he was born there in the hell, and he was told about this, you know, that, the punishments are mentioned. And there is this, because of the questions, and there is this knowing, and even over here, the human beings, although they do not know about this, for example, divine beings, even before the Buddha's time, you see the Potapada, they said that they were actually talking about, there are these great divine beings. And then they actually take the perception out and put it back and so and so. So it's
because
all known.
Because you hear it.
Yeah, you hear it.
Yeah, but because I thought the hell is much lower one than animal realm.
Yes, because of the suffering.
Yeah, but because
of the suffering wise, it is great.
Yeah, but when with the communication, that means the hell is better than animal world then.
The hell is, the problem with the hell is that it is so much suffering you can't escape easily. In the animal realm, you don't have that much suffering, but you can't sort of escape because you can't get the instructions. Those beings can't get out of it because of the karma. The bad karma, it is that strong. So either way, you got stuck.
Mm. So it's like you cannot compare one with the other one.
No. It's, but you can see the other one is better. You know, if you think about the dog of comparatively, you can see. And the plane of departed beings probably may be thinking, oh, it will be really good to be born as a human being. They enjoy and sort of thing. And human beings are actually thinking, oh, what a miserable life we got. Right? So we're thinking about the divine beings. And then the divine beings are thinking, oh, the Brahma's life may be really good. And eventually, all is impermanent. Although there is this gradual thing, you know, that one is better than the other, there's no doubt. You know, the Tamtin Sa is better than the Atul Maharajika. There's no doubt about it. But because of the lifespan and the pleasure. But at the end, all are fallen. You know, all can be fallen into the hell animal realm. So because of the instability, it's the bad thing. So that this person going into the space is infinite. So you can see at the level that we have the space is infinite maintaining the mind. There are 10 qualities of Nibbana in space is infinite. It is anyone can enter Nibbana, anyone can enter space, right? Like a bird flying over there. And no one can take it. You know, if you have a material thing, one can take it. The space, no one can take it. So there are qualities. And because of these qualities, one would actually like space is infinite, that level of concentration. It is really, really good compared to the other one. So you can see the one perception ceases, then another one comes in, out of the training. So getting rid of all the things, whenever you have the perception about the material things, earth or the human beings or whatever thing, you fall from that perception and you back to the previous perception, previous level. And if you got rid of that one, then you are in that level.
So it looks like it's you are clinging to one thing, so when you get rid of another thing.
Yes, like a small child, if you want to take something out of his hand, you give another toy or something, so you can take it out. So, but this toy is sort of refined, so that is better than the other one. Go into the next one.
Can you elaborate on infinite?
Well, so you are actually perceiving that the space is infinite. You know, if you think about the, imagine that's the world, now with the stars, you look at the sky for example. You can see that there is this space going to those stars, right? And the, do you cling to that space? No? Okay. You have a room at home, right? Do you like anybody to put boxes and boxes in that room while you are there? No. That means what? What did they take? They took your space. So you are clinging to the space. That's one has to be understood that one thoroughly. So we all cling to space. We cling to water, for example. You can see when the water is very rare, we all want water somehow. It's an essential thing. Like the space is like that. So people are fighting for the space. Right? So basically we cling to the space, but we do not know we cling to the space because we are our mind is occupied by all the other rubbish things, material things, houses and the buildings and all those things. But otherwise, space is perfect. Actually, when you are not a Buddhist, if you go into that level, if you maintain your mind in that level, you really feel like staying there. It is that level of thing happening with that. And because 99.9% of the time, your mind is occupied with this body, this disgusted body. You're trying to maintain it, you're trying to feed it, right? Earn money to get these things and then prepare it. And you wash it, you know, put into sleep, all those things. Now, imagine for a moment you don't have this body. 99.9% of the problem is gone. You're so happy. Because of those things are not impinging the mind, the material things. One with sensual desire might think, how would I actually get rid of this sensual desire and go into, I'm not happy to go there. So that person won't reach that one. But if you think the peril of these things, one can go out of that one and stay in that space. Maintaining that space is infinite. Like that the example where you are going to the star and looking at these things and all the other things are not mine and you maintain space is infinite. Like this carpet from here to here that is extend. Let's say it's extend into infinity. So you have the perception that this is not ending, that this infiniteness is there for the space. Your mind can be established on that using that technique. The technique that, you are not paying any attention. Not paying any attention to any material things. By disregarding them, this is not mine. That's the technique one can use. Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, for example, apply that technique. So, why we attach to these things, we consider them as significant for our living. And for our, the existence and so on. For it is me, for my son, or my children and so on. So we consider this material thing very significant. If you lose that significance because you see something better than that one, either by hearing from Buddha, you know, that this, for example, one attain this state, maintain that one, he will be living for 20,000 eons. 20,000 eons. The human being is, you know, that means this world is really getting contracted and, you know, expanded and contracted, destroyed. 20,000 times, that person still living. He doesn't have to earn money or anything to maintain that state.
Isn't that because you don't pay attention to the other things at all? That means other people or anything, because there is no competition over there. So there is only one thing. So that's why
you have one perception.
Yes.
Yes, you have one perception that space is infinite. Yeah, the material things are non-significant for me. Rupa sanya samatikkama, patika sanya tangama, nanatta sanya amanisakara. That means various kind of things that we don't have any attention to, these things. So our mind is like a, you know, the computer is always going to that one and this one, I got to do that, I got to do that, and so on. So that mind doesn't have to do any of those things. Space is infinite. So that's what it is. So, and then with the complete transcending of the dimension of the infinitude of space, perceiving infinite consciousness, the monk enters and remains in the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. His earlier perception of a refined truth of the dimension of the infinitude of space ceases. And on that occasion, there is a perception of a refined truth of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. On that occasion, he is one who is percipient of a refined truth of dimension of infinitude of consciousness. And thus, it is with that training, one perception arises, and with the training, another perception ceases. So we took this carpet as one example, you know, that sort of thing, that you got a sort of a yardstick here. That this carpet, imagine this one is extending to the left infinitely, to the right infinitely, right? So when I say that one, I am actually perceiving this carpet as something extending infinitely, right? Now let's drop the word carpet. And then I have the perception that this is extending infinitely. What is extending infinitely is the space. But would I need to use the word space here all the time? You see the point? You can actually maintain that this is infinite without the aid of the space. So then I can attain a state where the consciousness is infinite. What is infinite here? That the equanimity is maintained infinitely. That's what it is. Not paying any attention to either space or the material thing, consciousness is maintained in that one. At that time, what you actually feel, what you know from the consciousness, again, feeling. What is it feeling? Feeling of pleasure, displeasure, neither pleasurable nor non-pleasurable. That's what the feeling is. So, at that time, now in this discourse, you can see that one perception about the space now gone, now there is a perception about the consciousness. Consciousness is infinite, maintained. So, what you know from the consciousness is the feeling. So, if someone may have the knowledge that this feeling is constructed, that feeling is normally happening with the contact, right? So, we get the contact, there's this feeling. So, when you have, for example, two wood sticks, if you rub them together, then there's this heat that arises depending on the two. If you separate it, the heat ceases. Like that, this person understands this one is ceases when the contact ceases. Therefore, he is happy to give up that one as well. Whatever the desire he has got, this the consciousness is infinite. By thinking about the feeling, he give up his inclination about the feeling. How we go from the fourth jhana to space is infinite. We were not paying any attention to material things. Now we are not paying any attention to the feeling. So matter, feeling. First got rid of the matter. Now we are getting rid of the feeling. So then he will reach the seventh jhana level. So, and then with the complete transcending of infinitude of consciousness, thinking there is nothing, enter and remain in the dimension of nothingness. His earlier perception of a refined truth of dimension of the infinitude of consciousness ceases. And on that occasion, there is a perception of refined truth of the dimension of nothingness. On that occasion, there is one who is percipient of a refined truth of dimension of nothingness, and thus it is with that training one perception arises, and with training another perception ceases. This plane of nothing is a really beautiful thing compared to the, all the other things. It is that, you see, there are six elements. The element of extension, element of heat, element of motion, and element of cohesion. And then the space element, and then the consciousness element. So there were six elements. Now he got rid of all the six because why not paying attention to the feeling. So what he is left with? He left with nothing. So he reached plane of nothing. There is no thing, nothing. So it can be arrived in number of different ways. One way is to consider that these things are not mine. Any of those things so far are not mine. Whether even the perception or anything, they are not mine. So he disregard matter, disregard feeling, he disregard perception, he disregard this consciousness and the volition, the formation, all those things. He has not paying any attention to that one, and he reached this plane of nothing state. But in that state also, isn't that there is a perception? That there is no thing is a perception itself. Right? So you can see that along the way, one perception is gone, another one arises. Now when the monk is percipient of himself here, then from there to there, step by step, he touches the peak of perception. As he remains at the peak of perception, the thought occurs to him, thinking is bad for me. Not thinking is better for me. That first one is the chetiya manasami papyo. Papa. Thinking is bad. Not thinking is better for me. If I were to think and will, this perception of mine would cease. And gross perception would appear. If I am thinking, I get the other perceptions. What if I were neither to think nor to will? So he neither thinks nor wills. And as he is neither thinking nor willing, that perception ceases. And another grosser perception does not appear. He touches cessation. This pottapada is how there is the alert, step-by-step attainment of the ultimate cessation of perception. Now, Buddha was asking, now do you think, pottapada, have you ever before heard of such an alert step-by-step attainment of the ultimate cessation of perception? Whether he has heard it? No, Lord. And here is how I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One. So he is repeating all the steps that Buddha said. And then Buddha confirmed that one, that is right, pottapada. But Lord, does the Blessed One describe one peak of perception or many peaks of perception? That is, peak of perception is sanna agga. Agga, you know the agga, that meaning? Pottapada, I describe one peak of perception and many peaks of perception. And how does the Blessed One describe one peak of perception and many peaks of perception? In whatever way one touches cessation, nirodha, pottapada, that is the way I describe the peak of perception. That is how I describe one peak of perception and many peaks of perception. So you can see that to the mountain top of Siripada, one can go in different ways, but it's the same top, right? So, like that, and there are many ways. Now, Lord, does perception arise first and knowledge after? Or does knowledge arise first and perception after? Or do perception and knowledge arise simultaneously? It's a very good question. Whether we get the perception first or the knowledge. What about the perception arise first and knowledge after? And the arising of knowledge comes from the arising of perception. One discerns it is depending on this that my knowledge has arisen. Through this line of reasoning, one can realize how perception arises first and knowledge after, and how the arising of knowledge comes from the arising of perception. So you can see the Buddha was talking about this, you know, we have the perception of sense pleasures. And so Buddha is telling us that we need to develop the perception of impermanence, perception of not self, perception of suffering, all those perceptions, you know, the Girimananda Sutra, for example, 10 perceptions over here. Why? Because when you get the perception, you get the knowledge. It is from the perception, you get the knowledge. Now, Lord, is perception a person's self, or is perception one thing and self another? What self do you pass it, pottapada? That means what he is assuming or presuming as a self. I pass it gross self, possessed of form, made up of the four great existence, that is this element of heat, element of motion, element of extension, and element of cohesion, feeding on physical food. So he's saying that this, the self is that, you know, this body, you know, having this particular body. Then, Potapada, yourself would be gross, possessed of form, made up of the four great existence, feeding on physical food. That being the case, then for you, perception would be one thing and self another. And it is through this line of reasoning that one can realize how perception will be one thing and self another. Even as there remains this gross self possessed of form, made up of the four great existence and feeding on food, one perception arises for that person and another perception passes away. So that means that he got the, it remains that there is a gross self because that, you know, this the body is remaining. So there is this self, but the perception arises and passes away. Buddha said that with the training, one arises, the other one passes away. So therefore, the perception is not the same as the self, this material thing. Then Lord, I pass it a mind-made self, complete in all its parts, not inferior in its faculties. Then Potapada, yourself would be a mind-made, complete in all its parts, not inferior in its faculties. That being the case, then you, for you, perception would be one thing and self another. And it is through this line of reasoning that one can realize how perception will be one thing and self another. Even as there remains this mind-made self, complete in all parts, not inferior in its faculties, one perception arises for that person as another perception passes away. So that mind-made self is there, but the perception ceases. You know, with the training, it arises and ceases. So, well, in the mind-made body is sort of a perfect body, where it has got all the limbs, all those things, faculties, all those things are pure. You can travel and all those things from the mind-made body. And so, it is while this body is over here, one can have the mind-made body by attaining, you know, if you go beyond fourth jhana concentration, one can do that. Go from this, have a mind-made body. So, having got the mind-made body, you can see there is a mind-made body over there and there is the body over here, but you are not actually paying attention to this body. That means if you are paying attention, that means you are back to over here. Otherwise, at that time, you have the mind-made body over there and it can travel and sort of thing.
It's mind and body is a concept again, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, when you say concept, it's...
Concept mean, what I mean is...
Sanskar, yeah. It's out of the sanskar, it's from your volition that you have created this. So
that means the rupa part is there, because is the there. Shape and everything, that material is not there.
Materiality is there as well. Materiality is not gross like this.
Yeah, gross materiality is not there.
It's like if you take a glass, for example, if you see through the glass, if you look at your leg, if you have a mind-made body, you can see it's like a when you see a glass, you don't actually, if you are not grasping alone the lines of the glass, you don't see a sort of a body. So it's something like a transparent thing. And so you get these, it's hard to explain, but glass is a good example, or polythene or something, you know, that is a thin layer sort of thing. But but if you can see it, you would say that it's a material thing, right? But how refined that material is a different thing. So we normally, when say materiality, we were thinking about always hard, you know, but this gas is also materiality. So that again, with this reasoning, the mind-made body and the self is different. Then Lord, I pass it a formless self made of perception. Then Potapada, yourself would be formless and made of perception. That being the case, then for your perception would be one thing and self another. And it is through this line of reasoning that one can realize how perception will be one thing and self another. Even as there remains this formless self made of perception, one perception arises with the training, for example, and one ceases. So you can see the formless self made of perception is one thing and the perception is another. So that put the, over here you can see if you compare with the last week discourse, last week Buddha said that if someone regards the feeling as self, there are three kind of feeling, pleasure, displeasure and neutral. If someone says, well, which one of that is you are? So if someone says this pleasure, and then because pleasure ceases and the displeasure arises, then I myself disappear. Similarly, someone says that perception is self, this cross self, then you can see the perception arises and passes away. With the training we learn at the beginning. I'm keep on reminding because that this is going out of the mind when you read along the way. So with the training you can see, if you agree to the first path, with the training one ceases, then another one comes in. So you can see the perception is not the same as this one. And if you really understand this one to that extent, then you can see these are the states of consciousness. Actually, this discourse in this book says taste of consciousness rather than the Pottabhada Sutta. Because these are the state of consciousness. Now, if you understand perception, then you understand the consciousness to that degree. Because from the perception, you get the volition. Because of the volition, then we get the volitional formation and consciousness is constructed. So perception was the key here. Perceiving the feeling, perceiving those objects. If you understand perception to a greater degree, then you understand consciousness to a greater degree as well. So now you can see that, so now one can't regard the form as self or the feeling as self. And with this course you can see perception as self is also is not correct. Is it possible for me to know, Lord, whether perception is a person's self or if perception is one thing and self another? Pottabhada, having other views, other practices, other satisfactions, other aims, other teachers, it is hard for you to know whether perception is a person's self or if perception is one thing and self another. Well then, Lord, if having other views, other practices, other satisfactions, other aims, other teachers, it is hard for me to know whether perception is a person's self or if perception is one thing and self another, then is it the case that the cosmos is eternal? And that only this is true, anything otherwise is worthless. So Pottabhada, I have expounded that the cosmos is eternal, that only this is true and anything otherwise is worthless. That means this sasata loko, the world, is eternal. Whether is it eternal or not, that's his question. Can I understand that? So and he was asking whether it is so. Buddha said, no, I haven't declared that. So then he is asking whether the cosmos is not eternal. And Buddha said, I haven't expounded that the cosmos is not eternal. Asasata loko. And that only this is true and nothing else is worthless. Then is it the case that cosmos is finite? Cosmos is infinite. Soul and the body are the same. Soul is one thing and the body another. After death, Tathagata exists. After death, Tathagata does not exist. After death, Tathagata both exists and does not exist. After death, Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. That only this is true and anything otherwise is worthless. Pottabhada, I haven't expounded that after death Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist. That only this is the truth and anything otherwise is worthless. So all those questions Buddha did not answer. But why hasn't the Blessed One expounded these teachings, these things? Because they are not conducive to the goal, not conducive to Dhamma, are not basic to the holy life. That's why Buddha did not say that. They don't lead to disenchantment, that is nibbida, dispassion, viragaya, and cessation, nirodhaya, to calm, to direct knowledge, abhinyaya, self-awakening, sambodhaya, to unbinding. That is why I haven't expounded. That is the answer in these questions is useless. It's actually the meaning is going in two different sense and then one would only get confused by getting answers to these things. And what has Blessed One expounded? I have expounded that this is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. This is the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. That is, idam dukkanti. I am dukkha samudayo. Dukkha nirodhoti. Dukkha nirodhagamani patipada. That's what Buddha explained. And why has the Blessed One expounded these things? Because they are conducive to the core, conducive to the Dhamma, and basic to the holy life. They lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. That is why I have expounded them. So it is, Blessed One. So it is, O One, well gone. Well, now it is the time for Blessed One to do as he sees fit. Then the Blessed One got up from his seat and left. So when the Buddha left the place, all the other people were sort of, making faces and all those things to the Potapada and saying that, so whatever Gautama continually says, Sir Potapada rejoices in his every word. So it is, Blessed One, so it is. He did not understand, but he was saying this. And so Potapada was saying that, he replied, I too don't understand Gautama, the contemplative, as having taught any categorical teaching as to whether the cosmos is infinite, cosmos is those unanswered questions. But Gautama, the contemplative, described the genuine, authentic, and accurate practice grounded in the Dhamma and consonant with the Dhamma. And when a genuine, authentic, accurate practice grounded in the Dhamma and consonant with the Dhamma is being explained, why shouldn't a knowledgeable person such as myself rejoice in the well-spokenness of the Gautama, the contemplative's well-spoken words? Because although he does not understand these things, but he has some sort of a understanding that whatever thing Buddha described is genuine, authentic thing, that that it's grounded in the Dhamma.
That's the Sattva, isn't it?
Well, Sattva, he hasn't got the Sattva yet, but he got a bit of it. Other than the other people, Buddha later on said that he only got eyes. Others haven't got eyes in that group. And so bit of understanding, he can see this reasoning sort of thing is correct. I think probably we stop for today about this, because another 5 pages to go, maybe too much to go on for the Potapada Sutta. But this is the beauty of this discourse is actually coming in the meditation time without you noticing it. They first read the discourse and you go to do the meditation, normal meditation, you can see that the effect of this one. When I read this one first time, well, I got that understanding that one perception ceases, then another one comes in and sort of thing. But this is lengthy, and so you grab a little bit of it, but it's immense thing that you do not know the effect of this one until you do the meditation. When you do the meditation, then you can see that there is something this one is pushing you in that. Because the perception, as I understand, the perception is the one that take us in these wrong directions. Vipallasa. The topsy-turvy world, for example. We always take this foul thing as pleasurable, foul thing as fair, and the displeasure thing, we perceive them as, the pleasure. It is actually there is a pain, we perceive it as pleasure. The things, these are not mine, so we actually perceive this as mine. Things are impermanent, we perceive it as permanent. If you take your hair, you can see, while it is in the head, you can say it's beautiful and so on, right? And then if you see the same thing on the plate, you have a complete wrong see. This disgusting thing on my plate, put it out. So you can see that we have a wrong perception all the time about these things. So this one is setting that perception in the correct direction. And so because of the perception, we do many things like the volition and things. But if you get the perception right, that you see the impermanent nature of this perception, and it is, it one ceases, another one arises. One ceases, another one arises. What do you perceive from the perception most of the time? Have you thought about it? What do you perceive from the perception? What is the most significant thing you perceive? The feeling. You perceive the feeling. It's a really funny thing. You perceive the feeling that this is actually pleasurable. This is displeasure. And this is neutral. That's what you know. And that same message is actually now going to the consciousness. Now consciousness is now aware because of the feeling, well, I am pleasurable. I feel pleasure. I feel this pressure. So this pressure thing, you can see, as you can see over here, well, it goes from one to another. One ceases, another one comes in. So that pleasure we are valuing so much, if you think about the last week discourse, you can see that is the one leading to this, all the unhappiness, you know, the existence, birth, all those things creating from, starting from the pleasure. Because of the pleasure, there is this craving. Because of the craving, there is this seeking. Because of the seeking, we get it, labhati. And when we get it, we acquire it, then we investigate that one, you know, not investigate, it's vinichyo, that you look at it, you know, this is right, this is fit for me, this is good, and so on. And because of that one, we get chandaragas, desire and lust. Because of the desire and lust, this parigraha, you know, rajosati first comes in, that you are remaining holding to that one, and then you possess it. When you get you possess it, then this stinginess comes in much earlier. That, you know, there are five kind of thing, that this house is mine, and, you know, this thing, this house is for me and my family, sort of thing. This land is for me and my family, right? So even the Dhamma also get into that one. So because of that we protect. Arakti. And that one, so we actually kill each other as well. Because that, to protect this thing. So what's the origin? The feeling. It went through that path. That's one thing. The other part is that because of the feeling, and then we get this existence. That is another part. That was the question you were asking that day.
Yeah.
Those are the two them. That one is itself is really interesting. This is what is actually splitting in this ahara. This is the contact as the nutriment. Remember, in that part, it's actually you get one part is halfway through that five dhamma is the existence, bhava, right? The next part is the anger part. And this discourse is actually saying how it occurs. First you get the existence, and these things are mine and so on, so that there is this existence. And having got existence, so I am happy now, I got my everything in order, you know, I have eaten, I got my family, I got, you know, the car, job and all those things, and all of a sudden the impermanent nature comes in, and then you become angry. If you have the things, for example, let's say you have stinginess, you got your family and all those things, why are you upset all of a sudden? Because somebody is going to take something out of you. Your boundaries, your properties or something, right? So the impermanent things comes in and it plays it past, and then you go through that anger path. If you compare that Dhamma and then if you compare this Dhamma, you can see it is just this perception, what it did, it perceived those feelings. That troublesome thing that created the trouble, you know, not knowing that this leads to the trouble, just perceive that feeling and cling on to that one. So, because of the perception, there is this volition. And then it comes to that, this is mine, and sort of grabbing and sort of things. This is really good, but you need to have that the meditation done on about the matter and the feeling first. And if you have done that one, and this one is really valuable, this discourse. Okay, we will stop for today.